I want you to think back with me real quick to the last time that you had to take any sort of test for your driver's license. 6 years ago, I got a commercial driver's license so that I could drive a church bus when I was in Kansas City. And when I got my license, I actually had to take 6 different tests before I ever got behind the wheel for the driving test. So I had to repass a written test for the standard license. I had to pass the written test for the commercial license. I had to pass a written test for the passenger endorsement. I had to pass a pre-check inspection test where I had to walk the tester through an entire pre-check of the bus. Just talk to Alex and he'll tell you that's a miracle I passed that thing. You'd like know parts and names and other stuff. I had to pass a health test and I had to pass an eyesight test. Those are super nerve-wracking if you wear contacts that have, and you have an astigmatism. I blink once and all of a sudden everything's blurry. Don't worry, I never blink when I drive, so you're fine. But you get up there and it's all nerve-wracking. But only then did the tester get into the bus with me, make me drive the bus course, right? I had to maneuver this bus into tight areas around cones. I had to back the bus into tight spaces. And I had to drive the bus on city streets. I want you to think of the behind the wheel driving test as a test in wisdom. Everything else was knowledge, understanding, capability. Right, my standard license in 10 years of driving experience was like the base of knowledge and understanding to build on. But then I had to read this 200-page book for the commercial license, and some of it carried over, but some of it was really new. Everything for the passenger endorsement was new. The entire pre-check inspection was very new. I had to learn all sorts of parts on the bus. I had to understand what they did and why I was checking it. Even knowing what I was supposed to do and understand how it was all supposed to work didn't mean I was like capable of making it happen, right? Actually driving requires some physical ability, and so they make you take test after test. Finally, I was able to move from understanding to wisdom, right? I could act in some way that resulted in something, hopefully positive. But this is wisdom. Wisdom is acting in ways that are appropriate to your conditions based on what you know and what you understand. So turning a bus well is this act of wisdom. When you know how large your vehicle is and how you're supposed to maneuver, your ability to actually turn it exactly how you need is this act of practical wisdom. Or braking at just the right time with the right pressure is an act of wisdom that's built on knowing your speed and the size of your vehicle, along with a bunch of other factors. And you should become more and more wise, right? The more experience you have behind the wheel. The behind the wheel test is a test of whether you are wise enough to drive well and safely. Now, I want you to think about the men that Jeannie read about earlier. 4 guys, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, are this group of Jewish young men who are behind the wheel of a Babylonian car. And the driving test has begun. Are they wise enough to live well in a foreign nation? Do they have the wisdom to honor God in a hostile world? I don't know how well you know the story of Daniel, but some of you should recognize where the story begins. Chapter 1, verse 1. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. This story basically picks up where we all left off as a church last December as we finished the book of Kings, right? The nation of Judah has been unfaithful to God, and God announced that the Babylonians would conquer them and would take them away into exile. Verse 2 then reads, "And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, the land of Babylon, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God." Daniel makes it really clear what kings also claimed when we read last year. The Lord has given his people over to the Babylonians. God has removed his hand of protection from his covenant people. But as you can imagine, right, people tend to cling pretty tightly to the world as they know it. The people of Judah, they cannot imagine that God would allow their enemies to come and conquer them. And so rather than listen to the prophets who were telling them to surrender to the Babylonians, they fight back and they resist. And verse 1 tells us that this actually all gets really ugly. In the ancient world, there was almost nothing as bad as being besieged by an enemy army, because it meant that you were locked in a city and you were surrounded and you slowly ran out of food and water and you ran out of all of your resources. And Kings tells us that the conditions during these sieges got so bad, so terrible, that people were so desperate that women would eat newborn babies. People would kill each other and resort to cannibalism. And these accounts are consistent with other places where warfare has resulted in sieges and desperation. Siege was this horrific condition in the ancient world that the people of Judah brought on themselves as they refused to trust that God was telling them to surrender to the Babylonians. But then finally the siege breaks. The Babylonians, they march in and they make this declaration. They say, "The God of Israel has given Israel over to the Babylonians." And so they take from the temple the vessels of Israel's God and they carry them back home to Babylon as a symbol of their victory, of God having given them over. But that's not the only thing they took. They also took Judah's best and brightest young men. In verse 3, we read, "The king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Babylonians." If we were to think about what this was like in light of some modern events, it would be like ISIS inflicting huge casualties on American citizens here in our own country. And then them marching in and grabbing the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution to put on display in their own capital setting somewhere. And finally, as a final act of sort of in your face, right, they would swoop in to each of our military academies, Annapolis and West Point, and take our very best students back with them. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are these young men who have been taken. And they've been taken captive because of their brilliance and because of their abilities and their influence, and they have lost everything. They've been taken from their home and their families and their jobs. And together with these vessels from the temple, they make this march to Babylon. Captivity. This is utterly devastating for a people, right? The loss of life, what felt like the absence of God, the lack of any hope for the future, the loss of any national identity. In the midst of all this, we read in verse 8, "Deep in the heart of Babylon, Daniel resolved. In verse 8, years of education, of training, of practice in wisdom result in wise action from Daniel. Remember the definition I gave of wisdom earlier. Wisdom is acting in ways that are appropriate to your conditions based on what you know and what you understand. And here Daniel makes a resolute decision. He would not eat the king's food or drink the king's wine because of what we see in Daniel later in the book. It's safe to assume that Daniel prays to God about this. Daniel seems to always be praying. In fact, we find out later it's his practice to pray at least 3 times a day. This story, though, doesn't tell us that God instructed Daniel to refuse the king's food and drink. It just tells us that after Daniel makes this decision, the Lord gives him favor. But what's so interesting to me about this is when Daniel makes this commitment. Because in verse 5, we are told this. The king assigned these men a daily portion of food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. These young men were to be educated for 3 years. And at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. Daniel resolves himself to not eat the king's food or drink the king's drink right after this act of being renamed. Well, the name Daniel means my judge is God. The name Belteshazzar speaks of the Babylonian god Bel and calls Bel the protector. So get what's happening. This young Jewish boy has been given by his Jewish family a name that announces that the God of Israel is the one who is the good and faithful judge, who's capable of making wise decisions. And he has now been renamed by his captors, by the Babylonians, so that his new name declares it is the God of the Babylonians who protects. One after another, this continues. Hananiah, whose name means Yahweh shows grace, has his name changed to Shadrach, which means command of Aku. Aku is the Babylonian moon god. Mishael, which means who is that? Who is what God is named Meshach, or who is like Aku. And Azariah, which means Yahweh has helped, is renamed Abednego, or the servant of Nebo. The king of Babylon and his servants are not just trying to make these boys feel welcomed in Babylon with lots of great food and drink and a party and Babylonian names, right? Like, they're not just trying to give them names so that they fit in. They are trying to convert them, to turn them into good Babylonians. Right, they have renamed these young men. They have given them new identities. So that, like, by these new names, their lives now testify to new gods. By new food and new drink, their lives are now given over to new sorts of desires. By teaching them new literature and new language, their lives can now be directed by new stories. And bit by bit, over 3 years, they will conform and be transformed into good Babylonians. This is the strategy anyway. But Daniel understands what is happening. Daniel knows what is going on. And when he and his friends are renamed, he resolves to act. Daniel is wise in a way that I'm not sure American Christians are. As we read the book of Daniel, most Christians who know Daniel's friends by name, from memory, know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I think this says something about our knowledge and our understanding. I think it suggests that we might lack the prereqs for acting wisely. Because if we can't tell in Scripture when God's people are being renamed and being shaped in the image of other cultures and other gods, then we probably won't recognize it when it's happening to us. When our culture gives us new names, when our culture invites us into a new way of life to drink from the cup of Babylon. But Daniel understands exactly what he is facing. When Daniel resolves himself not to eat or drink from the king's table, he uses a very specific word, or a very specific word is used here. Daniel will not defile himself. So that when he addresses this king's servant, he asks that he not be required to defile himself. So Daniel doesn't just have this idea like, oh, I know a good diet that will help me like do well here. Now, Daniel's understanding of defilement comes from the book of Leviticus, a book he clearly knew well. And it comes from this firm understanding that food can often represent loyalty and allegiance to the one true God or loyalty to other gods. The Apostle Paul will make this case in the first letter to the Corinthians when he argues that food sacrificed to idols might hurt your ability to announce Jesus as Lord. And this is exactly what's happening. The meat at the king's table had all come from animals that were sacrificed to the gods of Babylon. To eat this meat was to publicly put your trust in these gods. The wine drunk at the king's table meant the exact same thing. For Daniel, who had already been renamed and was now being called by a name pointing to the gods of Babylon, for Daniel to refuse food and wine became an act of resistance. There was this very public part of Daniel's life that would not be aligned with the gods of Babylon and the ways of Babylon. Daniel wisely discerned how and where he could opt out of the Babylonian way of life. And this first chapter of Daniel makes a subtle suggestion about Daniel and his friends. See, because for the rest of this chapter, we're told that they have been renamed, but the rest of the chapter refers to Daniel and the boys by their Hebrew names, right? There's this subtle act of resistance. Something is happening. There's a sense in which even with new names, these men have never lost their God-given identities. They have maintained their public loyalty to God. Even though they've been renamed, their names bearing God's name could not be overcome. This required a deliberate act of wise driving on Daniel's part. Because he's in a land without a temple. He's in a land without sacrifices. You could pretty much assume the entire book of Leviticus had no value in this place. But Daniel and his friends wisely lived out the deep truths of Leviticus by finding a way to maintain a distinct identity within the Babylon that was ravenously trying to swallow them. The call of this passage on us is whether we can maintain a distinct identity around the person of Jesus within a larger culture that is ravenously trying to swallow us. Living in Babylon meant opting out of certain public acts that were at the very heart of public life in Babylon. These men tell no one else that they have to live this way. I love this about Daniel and these guys, right? They don't start to rail against the sin of their culture, of the Babylonians, you terrible people who eat meat, sacrifice to idols. They just say, can we not? And they quietly live this alternative way in the midst of their culture. Which is why living in Babylon isn't actually just about opting out, right, and not living in certain ways. It also requires opting in. Think about this. Daniel and the boys were already highly educated. They were already incredibly wise, but their education and their wisdom was almost entirely oriented to helping them live in the land that God had given them. So it's like Christians in our country today, right? Who grew up during a time when cultural Christianity was the norm of our day. Many, many knew how to live well in such a place, right? When nothing but church ever happened on Sundays. That one time when somebody scheduled something on Sunday, you just said, I can't do it. But to live here now, so much has changed. It is so fundamentally different. New ways of living are required, right? When Sundays are a day just like any other, what does it mean for the church to prioritize congregational worship and the practice of Sabbath? For Daniel and these guys to live wisely in a foreign land, in Babylon, this place where they were now this tiny minority, it meant that they had to further their education. They had to gain greater wisdom. And this is truly amazing because they submit themselves to 3 years of Babylonian education. And the Babylonians meant this for their harm, right? They meant it to change them. But what the Babylonian king meant for harm, God used for good. The king of Babylon wanted to educate these Jewish men so that they could become great Babylonians. God used their education to help them become great Jews in the midst of Babylon. When we pick up the story in verse 18, the 3 years of the Babylonian education is now over. And all of the men are brought before the king. And in verse 19, we read this: the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all of the magicians and the enchanters that were in his kingdom. They weren't like real, like magicians, like the way we think of magicians. These were like their wise men. Think of the magi in the Christmas story. Daniel and his friends, they know where to opt in to Babylon, and they know where to opt out. They opt out of Babylon when their loyalty to their God might come into question. But they opt in when they can become better servants of the king and the nation. Can I say this? I think the church often gets this backwards. Christians often opt out of things like education. Places where we could learn to deeply understand the ways of our culture. I think we're mostly afraid of education. And I think this is because there's a sense that very few of us are trained in the ways of the Lord as Daniel and his friends were. And so we're not confident of the training we have received, that it might hold firm the way that David and his friends did. We opt out of the education that would give us the chance to become the best scientists and doctors and lawyers and authors and builders and entrepreneurs and parents and secretaries that the world has ever seen. I mean, there is this incredible reality in this passage that these men become the best because they start with the Lord's wisdom and understanding, and then they are able to engage another culture dynamically and with the Lord's revelation, and they are far more capable of the people there. I don't know if you've had this experience, but it seems like far too often the world looks at Christians and just sees ignorance. Like, we don't really understand our faith very well. Like, we don't have great reasons for some of the things that we do. We try to speak to social issues or political issues or scientific issues without really understanding them. But Daniel and his friends, they exceeded their peers 10 times. And in doing so, they became a blessing to Babylon. I mean, let me just say, like, they became a blessing to the people who robbed them of their homes. They became a blessing to the people who stripped them from their families. They became a blessing to their greatest enemies. This is incredible. And so, the question is, will we be a blessing where we live? But it's interesting, we often opt out of some of the primary ways that we could serve Babylon. We often opt out of the ways that would help train us, help us become a blessing to our neighborhoods and to our cities and to our nation. Or if we do try to engage, we don't really try to understand. We don't really try to act wisely. And so we do a bad job sometimes of serving. There's a whole book called When Helping Hurts that reflects on some of these ways the church has intended well, but hasn't really thought well about the task of serving the world. And often it's because we just don't understand the world we live in and its issues. All the while, we often seem far too interested in opting in to cultural practices that maybe we should be more discerning about. Right? Like, we're so busy trying to fit in and seem normal in our culture that we opt into cultural values like consumerism and materialism. We opt into cultural definitions of beauty and of love. We opt into the cultural practices of divorce and sexuality. And I'm not sure that we have developed the wisdom to opt in and opt out of our culture in the ways that are appropriate and faithful to the way of Jesus. I'm going to wrap up here in the next minute or so. So let me say this. As I think about my job, as I think about what I get to do as part of this community, as pastor, there's an image that I have that sort of drives what I see myself being called to do. And not just myself, but pastors. And it's this image. Should we be scattered? My question is, what would happen to each of you? Should persecution come? Should something cause all of us to separate? And all of our ministry, like organized, structured, anything, cease to exist, would each of you have what you need to continue walking with Jesus and to, on your own, be making disciples along the way? Like, these are the questions that keep me up at night. Have I equipped you with the knowledge and understanding to live wisely as God's people in the world? Are you able to keep learning and growing on your own apart from me? Are you able to invest in other people? Or do you still need to be fed? Of course, God is intimately involved in all of this. And we read this in this passage that God is the one who is helping them to have this understanding and this wisdom. But this is part of the role of a pastor in God's church. And I believe that for many decades, the church has neglected its responsibility to teach God's people to live wisely in a world that's hostile to our faith. To go back to my opening analogy, like we have been putting teenagers in cars that they are not prepared to drive well. Right? They're incapable of acting wisely because behind the wheel, because they haven't really read the book, they haven't attended the class, they haven't put in the practice, not like Daniel. We have had this really laid back view of how we learn and grow, sort of hoping it happens just by showing up. And Daniel 1 just tells us that we have to be more intentional. Not only were Daniel and his friends ready, right? I mean, think about it. They lost every ounce of support structure that they had, and they were ready. They went to a place that was militantly opposed to them and their lives, trying to undo their faith. This place they went so understood that intentional education and reformation is necessary to change a person that they were able to respond. Now, Babylon failed to make them into their kind of Babylonians, but they devoted 3 years to this deliberate formative training to undo their faith formation that these men had gone through at home. It shouldn't then surprise us that as we jump to the New Testament, as we find the life of Jesus, how many years does he devote to this same kind of intense and immersive training, education, and formative program with his disciples? 3 years. That's really interesting, right? But it shouldn't surprise us that Jesus then does stuff like rename the disciples. Wait a second, I've seen that trick before. And, oh, that's interesting. Jesus also teaches them how to eat and drink. I've seen that one too. It's almost like Jesus is working out of the Babylonian playbook, except it's not the Babylonian playbook. It started with the formation that God's people got before they went to Babylon. But Jesus just understands what's necessary to prepare disciples to go out into the world and represent him well when he leaves. And I don't think in our context, we really have the patience for 3 years. That's a lot of years. Like I wanna skip the hard stuff. I just wanna jump in. It's interesting to me that Jesus doesn't pick men like Daniel. Did you notice that? Daniel and his friends, they're the cream of the crop. They are the most educated. They are the most prepared. They are the most ready. But Jesus doesn't pick them, the Daniels and the Hananias and Azariahs. Religious leaders have learned some really bad habits that are going to be really hard to break. My assumption, reading the Gospels and seeing what Jesus does, is that he looks at the religious leaders, he goes, they're going to take longer than 3 years. I've only got three here. So I'm starting with these guys. They're flexible-ish. The disciples may not have been educated when they start, but man, they've got serious knowledge and understanding by the time Jesus is done with them. Right? The New Testament shows us how these disciples then move from Jesus as Jesus is gone and how they live wisely in a hostile world with their new training that they've received from Jesus. You know who's a really interesting example? Is a guy named Saul, who was a Pharisee, a religious leader. The sense you get from Acts is that he knows something about Jesus. Right? He's been hunting these followers of Jesus. He knows something of him. He knows something of the teaching. He understands what's going on. He has received some. There's some period of time where he has been instructed and he has actively resisted and attempted to kill those who would follow Jesus. But when he is converted, where does he go? In one of his letters, we learn that he goes off for, it's a really easy guess, how many years? Three, yeah, he goes off for 3 years. And the, most traditions assume that this is for a serious program of re-education. See, Paul needs to unlearn the ways of Saul. That's interesting, Paul got a new name. And he needs to learn the ways of Jesus. Read Paul's letters and you'll see that he has some ideas about eating and drinking that didn't come from his Pharisee training. But the truth is, this just takes time. It takes learning, it takes understanding, it takes practice to allow the Spirit of God to form us as people who look like Jesus and who live like Jesus in the world. But this is clearly God's expectation. And so it shouldn't surprise us when the early church develops a 3-year intentional program for educating and reforming people who say, I'm interested in following Jesus. They say, okay, cool. We will train you how to know God, follow Jesus, imitate him, how to hear God's word and how to pray and how to do justice and how to care for the poor and for the widows, right? Like this all requires intentional, deliberate training. And it shouldn't surprise us that in those early years of the church, when persecution was at one of its highest points, that followers of Jesus constantly being scattered everywhere didn't fall away, but seemed skilled at reproducing themselves time and again, everywhere they were being scattered to. There's a beauty in hearing this passage this morning. As we prepare in a few minutes to celebrate in a baby dedication with Austin and Lauren. Because in many ways, this passage frames their act of dedication as something far bigger than just an ordinary ritual on a Sunday morning, right? That the call that God has placed on their lives is big. To love their son with the love of Christ. To teach him. To fill him with knowledge. To train him in understanding. To help him practice wisdom. To help him know the love of God demonstrated in Jesus. And that's why before we get to the dedication this morning, we'll actually eat and drink together. We'll come to the table. This dedication happens in the context of a faith family, and it happens within the grace of our Lord Jesus. We come to the table every single week because it's here that we learned. It's here that we learn that there are new and there are better ways of eating and drinking. In our culture, in our world, tables are, maybe you've had this experience. Have you ever been at a restaurant or a coffee shop and had a European sit with you at your table? Like just show up and like sit down at your table. Like I'm talking about here in the States. Have you ever had this experience? If you've never had this experience, get ready for it or just travel to Europe and you can have it all the time. Nobody has like individual tables. So if you sit at a table with four people, you can expect other people to join you at your table. Tables for us are pretty symbolic of who is included and who is not. And we're not very open to weird strangers sitting at our tables with us. This happens to me when I go to San Francisco, coffee shops usually. this table says that everybody belongs. This table reorients us to new ways of eating that say there is no rich and there is no poor, there is no Jew, there is no Gentile. Everyone is included. In the church, sometimes that means that our children, as much as our seniors, have a place and are loved and are valued.